From WXXI News in Rochester, I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, and this is Connections Arts Friday. If you are a reader of a certain ambition, you have probably confronted the challenge that is David Foster Wallace. When he committed suicide in 2008, the Ithaca native left behind a legacy of work that included not only short stories and essays, but some of the most complex novels of the late 20th century. Infinite Jest, which is widely but not universally regarded as his masterpiece, runs over 1,000 pages with hundreds of footnotes, holding it right now, in fact, magic of radio. Wallace has been back in the literary spotlight lately as the subject of a new film, The End of the Tour, which just wrapped up a run at the Little last night. Joining us this hour to talk about David Foster Wallace, Chad Post, who is the publisher of Open Letter Books at the University of Rochester.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Steve Brower is an associate professor of English at St. John Fisher, who focuses on American literature and culture.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Thanks.
And Sarah Freely is a poet and writer of fiction and an associate professor of creative writing at St. John Fisher.
Hi, Scott. Thanks.
Thanks for being with us. And joining us by phone is Christopher Duva. He is an actor and writer who created and performed in a one-man play called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, based on one of Wallace's most popular essays. It premieres later this month at the Fringe NYC Festival in New York. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. Let's get started, Christopher, with you. It is not always easy when you are an artist trying to create an adaptation of an existing piece of work to actually get the rights and the permission, in this case of an estate, to go ahead and do what you're doing. In this case, you did get that permission, but you started off with actually a different piece from David Foster Wallace that you couldn't get, right?
Yes, actually. I had corresponded with David when he was alive about his short story collection, Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. And we had a connection through my wife, who's actually directing the current production, as they're both Amherst alums and knew each other. And unfortunately at that point, the rights were tied up in a film. And so I had to abandon the project. And then, I came across the letter that David wrote me in response to this project about 2 years ago, and it sort of felt like unfinished business. And the piece that I've always loved and was really the first piece of David that I ever read was A Supposedly Fun Thing, when it was titled Shipping Out in Harper's Magazine in 1996, and I contacted Bonnie Nadell, who was David's lifelong agent, and she and Karen Green, David's widow, granted me the rights to do this as a show or the stage.
And this is a piece, you know, people think, I think sometimes when we get into talking about some of these writers that we're talking about things that are inaccessible, that are not necessarily amusing. This is an hysterically funny piece that he wrote about his experience as somebody who's not big on the whole idea of going on a cruise. He was sent off by Harper's to go on this cruise out of Florida for 7 days in the Caribbean. Talk to me a little bit about the funny side of David Foster Wallace.
Well, he always protested that he didn't really know what was funny. I think that was sort of a little disingenuous on his part. But he also used to say that Harper's had figured out a grand formula with using him as a journalist, which was to decide collectively on the least likely thing they could see David Foster Wallace doing and pay for him to do it with absolutely no direction, so that he would then pay attention to absolutely everything because he'd be so panicked about what he was supposed to write about.
Which is something that we've seen done fairly recently too. I forget if it was Harper's or someone, or no, it was the New York Times Magazine that was sending Nausgaard off on that on that journey into the Midwest that was very kind of Wallace-esque in terms of him writing about losing his passport and everything that was going wrong with him before he even got started on the trip. Let me open it up to the panel here. I guess if you're trying to introduce David Foster Wallace to somebody who hasn't picked him up yet, What do you tell them? How do you introduce him?
I want to stay with that for 1 second, what you just said about the essays. That sort of, one of the many lasting legacies of David Foster Wallace is that sort of hyper-attentive, journalistic first-person piece. I mean, that's become like not necessarily standard, but like the Nosgard you mentioned, and a lot of younger writers like Wells Tower, people like guy who's I know whose name I'm blanking out on, that write these sort of pieces that go to a situation and have that kind of attentive, hyper-realistic vision and pick out all those pieces. And that's what makes it funny, and also is like what kind of introduces us, makes us human, gives us a perspective on something we don't already have. One of my best friends works for Rolling Stone, Mark Benelli, and he does that sort of writing as well, and has written about Detroit and Bernie Sanders and people selling pot in Boise, Idaho.
But that's got
all fun.
That has a long, long tradition that started with the so-called new journalists in the 60s, Gay Talese, Norman Mailer.
Right.
God, you know, like Tom Wolfe.
Tom Wolfe, absolutely.
What I think,
Charles Portis.
Yeah, what I think Wallace does in those pieces, though, that's really compelling, it's deeply observed, and he's very much in the middle of it, but he's got a real compassion for the people he's writing about.
Right.
It's very generous. And so if I were talking to a reader, and I have done this before on vacation, people are like, what are you reading? And I'm like, I'm reading essays. And they're like, really? but I say, you know, these are they're wonderful pieces where he takes you into something, and it's not judgmental in the way that you think it's going to be. What he does in Consider the Lobster is amazing, how he slowly but surely moves you to this point where you feel implicated.
You are the lobster.
In what's going on, and you're like, wow. And my family was on Cape Cod a month ago, and I was just telling my son about this essay this morning, and he got this look on his face. He's 12. Like, I'm not supposed to eat those anymore, am I, Dad?
Yeah, I don't dare show that one. I have my 11-year-old is very sensitive to those things.
Right.
If I give her that to read, I'm never wrong.
Yeah, but that compassion really marks his work, I think. Yeah.
I think it more so his essays than his fiction. We were talking about this before the show, that he's considered a postmodern writer, but he's really past postmodern. He's post-post in that he does the compassion, the morality that really comes through, particularly on the essays. I've shared Consider the Lobster, which is, I consider, straightforward and great and empathic with students.
There's something to add to that from the Charlie Rose interview that he did way back for Infinite Jest, in which that question comes up. That interview is very odd, by the way, if you watch it nowadays. Like, it's just odd, through and through. But like when Charlie Rose says, like, what do you think of the English Patient? And David Foster Wallace is like, really? Seriously? That's what you're asking me now? Why? But he does talk.
Certainly hadn't prepared a lot.
Yeah, he does talk about the postmodern thing when Charlie Rose is like, "What is postmodernism?" And he's like, "You know, it's anything after modernism." But he's like, "The thing about it was all the cynicism, the jokes, the sort of things that enervated culture in the '60s that created like this postmodern boom of the Pynch and the Gaddis, the Coover, the Barth, all of those writers. That sort of ran out by the time that David, who had been reading those, was becoming a full-fledged writer. That, as he puts it, like Burger King sells hamburgers being like, eat different or whatever it is, or Apple does that too. Yeah. But like, it's not that sort of cynicism, that sort of irony was already so infused in culture that you can't be postmodern in the way that postmodern writers of the 60s that are the big ones
He rejected irony.
So
he
it goes past him. That. So,
yeah,
it has to.
Because that was
he
a
rejected
position. Yeah. I mean,
I'm sorry.
Chris, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm not at the table, so it's hard to.
I'm barely at the table at this point.
there's also a significant shift in Wallace's writing between Girl with Curious Hair, which is his second published piece, his short story collection, and Infinite Jest, which is that shift from a sort of a person who worshipped and wanted to outdo the Pynchons and Gaddises and parts of the world, and then becoming his own writer, which also happened to coincide with his stint in a rehab facility and his getting clean, and a major shift in the way he lived his life, all of which happened during the writing of Infinite Jest, after which he had sort of been the golden boy for a minute and then had seen that mantle pass on to other people and then sort of came back and rose from the ashes. So there, if you want that postmodernism stuff, his first novel and story collection are great examples of that to the nth degree. And then he sort of became his own writer, I think, with Infinite Jest.
We are talking about David Foster Wallace on Connections Arts Friday. We want to mention, if you want to try to jump into this conversation too, we encourage you to do so at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And Sarah, you've got
I have read that he began Infinite Jest in 1986, began writing what would be the first sort of drafts of that. I don't know if any of them still exist. His papers are at University of Texas, I believe. But yeah, that preceded, I think, as what you were saying, his stint in rehab and getting clean. And
yeah, I from what I know, it was written in many sections over the years, and there is a there's a fabulous piece in the Howling Phantod website, which is the sort of premier David Foster Wallace website, about the first draft of, and many references to changes and stuff that one of his friends, I believe from University of Arizona, was handed of Infinite Jest.
I want to sort of turn the conversation here a little bit to David Foster Wallace as a person. One of the reasons why we're having this particular conversation right now, of course, is because of the movie, The End of the Tour, which is out making its way around theaters right now. We have with us, Chris, you've at least exchanged emails with Wallace when he was alive, and Chad, you had some encounters with him when you were in Illinois as well. What should we take away? You know, and I'll put my cards on the table. I haven't seen the movie yet. I meant to get there, and it closed at the Little. I got to wait for it to come around, I guess, on pay-per-view now. But Sarah, you've seen the movie.
I have.
Chris, I assume you've seen it by now too.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Let's talk about David Foster Wallace, the person, how the movie treated him, and how that comports with the real David Foster Wallace that that some of you at least had the privilege of encountering.
I think you guys have to start, since you've seen the movie and I have not.
I have. I would start by, I agree with A.O. Scott, whose review in the New York Times touched on a lot of the issues that that worried people, particularly people who were close to him, that how dare you do this movie on David Foster Wallace. And I know his estate had nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. But his argument, and having seen it too, it's not about David Foster Wallace. It's about writers. It's more about David Lipsky, the character played by Jesse Eisenberg, than it is about David Foster Wallace, although David Foster Wallace plays a huge part of it. It's this dance that writers do. It approaches a lot of things that are interesting to me as a writer. That is this contradiction. You want attention. You want people to read your work. You are not sitting there typing in your underwear at night going, gee, I hope nobody reads this poem, which they won't, but you want people to read you, but you crave and need solitude at the same time in order to do your work. And the movie, I think, does a wonderful job of touching on that. Also, the difference between the journalist who is after and wants something from somebody in a profile and the writer, David Foster Wallace, who is understands that on some level, but is still not not going to give him everything that he wants or needs. He's going to protect parts of himself. So I found it fascinating. It was a dance between two men, sword play, for lack of a better word, because I can't say the other thing.
Chris?
Yeah, I'd agree that it's to me, the film was much more about David Lipsky. I'm, you know, having worked with the estate, I understand their reasons, and being a David Foster Wallace fan, I'm happy when anything gets to introduce him to a wider public, which I think this film does, because David, it seemed to me, had a hard time not being brilliant in terms of just talking about, he could turn any subject into a sort of entertaining and intellectually thoughtful discussion, and this film does bring that about, and I can only imagine that people who are just introduced to him via it will want to read his work, which is a great thing.
I can tell you, when going out, you know, after Evan said, hey, you want to do a David Foster Wallace show? I said, yeah, I guess I'm going to have to do some reading, huh? And I went out just to try to get a copy of Infinite Jest. I can tell you right now, there is not one to be had at any public library in Monroe County, and hasn't been for
really
for a little while. So take that for what, and Lipsky's book too was hard to find.
Wow. That's actually really interesting. I had looked up a couple things about the movie since I didn't have a chance to see it when I was here either. And one of the great quotes, because I was at, to give this a bit of background, I was at Illinois State University as an employee working for Delkey Archive Press, which was based there. had been based there since, I think, 93, 94. But at that point in time, there were a couple academics, namely Charlie Harris and then Bob McLaughlin, who were putting together a Center for Contemporary Literature at the university. So they got Curtis White, who's a great writer and cultural critic, to come there, whose papers are here in Rochester, weirdly enough, and David, along with Delkey Archive. And so it was like kind of a hotspot for contemporary writing at that period in time. If you're interested in the more experimental, more innovative vein of literature, you could come study it and write it there. Anyways, I saw that Bob McLaughlin gave one of the intro speeches to the premiere of the movie in Normal, Illinois, where Illinois State's based. And someone asked him about like what he thought David would think. And he's like, oh, he would have hated this, that there is a movie about him. And that was the first thought that I had when I heard there was going to be a movie, is that is not... not the David that I encountered would be anyone who would want his likeness on a screen. He was very modest and very genuine in a lot of like human ways.
I think Jason Segel plays him that way. He's very understated, almost as to be invisible, but he has this big body that is, you know, like just can't be invisible. But I thought he did, you know, I thought both of them work well together.
Cards on the table here again. I'm a little more than a third of the way through Infinite Jest at the moment. Mm-hmm. I do intend to finish it to the extent that it actually can be finished. And what strikes me is in how many things that he anticipated.
Yeah. Right.
Within the book, because there's this whole, you know, among the many subplots that are worming their way through this is this subplot where one of the characters, Orrin the football star, is being pursued by somebody who's allegedly writing a profile on him and actually apparently has some rather different motives. But he thought about this. This was something, you know, he wrote about that in there.
He was uncomfortable with some of the idea of fame and that kind of stuff. There's one specific instance I remember him talking to John O'Brien, the publisher of Delkey Archive, about how I think it was the New Yorker, it may have been the New York Times, is one of the big publications in New York, had listed him as one of New York's most eligible bachelors when Infinite Jest came out. And he's like, I live in Bloomington, Normal, Illinois, first of all. And like, that's not something that he was at all comfortable with. So right. It's not surprising that comes up in the book and comes up several times in his works.
And he wrote a lot about the sort of contemporary media apparatus, right? Mm-hmm. Both in his fiction and then in his nonfiction.
Well, he was a
constantly
TV
addict. Yeah, he's writing about television and his relationship to fiction. He's writing about the radio host. He's really the John McCain thing as much as about sort of the contemporary media moment than anything, right? And sort of the, you know, Up Simba, is that what was the name of that? He was very much attuned. He's very much a writer of the moment, it seems to me, who was very much trying to engage with what is this really getting at and what are we losing it.
But also I think dystopian writers, and I'm thinking of not just David Foster Wallace, Margaret Atwood, who's The Handmaid's Tale in 1985, did a lot of what David Foster Wallace did, is that they're taking what's here now and kind of saying, okay, what if, and multiplying it to the, degree and going, oh, my God.
Gary,
you know,
Steingart's
super. We have the year of the Whopper, and the years are bought by corporations and named. You know, they get these sponsorship rights to it, total years.
And the capitalization, the way, apparently in a dystopian future, that was everything is capitalized.
Well, that was David Foster Wallace's thing, plus those long run-on sentences and the footnotes, 388 of them.
Well, he started it, but it certainly showed up enough.
But, you know, when I read The Wasteland, it's full of footnotes.
It is.
Right?
It
I mean, there's something that's not that different to me. It is part of a tradition. And what I think what a lot of people responded to was, he's right of the moment, and this is how sort of the contemporary mind works with hyperlinks. He seemed to engage it and bring it into his work in a perhaps more conscious way. But it doesn't feel to me as if it doesn't come out of something. Reading essays can be this way. Reading Montaigne can be this way.
Right. Well, and also I think the thing that people really respond to or have responded to is that he was, as someone said, a writer of the moment. He was not trying to be a writer, and he knew, like a great painter, he knew all the moves and all the works of his predecessors and worked on copying them. But his great sort of achievement was funneling through that through the present moment that he lived in, and then also extrapolating what the consequences of that moment were going to be. I mean, one of the main, well, not a main character, a subsidiary character in Infinite Jest is Johnny Gentle, who is the president of the United States,
who's singer,
a former entertainer and salesman. And we are tantalizingly close to that moment right now with Donald Trump's candidacy.
Ooh, sure. And Kanye.
And Ronald Reagan.
Well, and he also lived through, I mean, he grew up in Reagan's era, too. So I think one of the things, and especially in his essay, E Plurum Unibus, he talks about what it means to be a writer now, mm-hmm. you know, rather than a writer who inherits the cliches of irony and postmodernism. And I think that's why he stood out from the pack, because he was such an individual voice.
We've been talking about Wallace as we'll get there. I promise. we've been talking about Wallace as a writer. I want to talk about what the experience is like as a reader too. And I want to bring in some of our callers here. 844-295-8255. Ricky, you're joining us from Rochester, and you said you found it difficult reading going through Wallace.
Oh, goodness. I mean, I normally, like, Franz Zen, something a little more cinematic and real, and this thing was just, like, spinning down a rabbit hole reading. like, for me, like, I like, you know, like, simple, straightforward things. Like for instance, I'll listen to Hoobastank, and they have this lyric that says, "Is there something more than what I've been handed? I've been crawling through the dark, looking for the answers." And that's what it's like reading him for me. I'm just crawling through the dark, trying to find an answer, and it's just a maze.
Are you reading
Is it like that for you guys?
Are you reading Infinite Jest, the novel? I would recommend doing I would recommend starting with the creative nonfiction, which is collections of pieces that he's done for, you know, like Scott was talking about the Harper's piece and Esquire.
Two comments, really. One is, I actually usually tell people to start with Brief Interviews of Hideous Men, because mm-hmm. I think that's like very pointed. There's fun with it. It's interesting. It's a wonderfully constructed book that isn't, I mean, it doesn't fit like a normal novelistic category. Right. But with Infinite Jest too, like, and all this, the, you know, maybe I'm just jaded and or have read too many of these difficult books, but I don't think that it's difficult in that sense. You just gotta go along with it. Like, if you let each piece speak to it for itself, each section is so immersive, is so well crafted, is funny, is like creating characters, is creating like wonderful linguistic things that are happening on the page. And then maybe you go to a footnote in the back, and there's this great interplay between like the rehab center and the tennis academy, and between the main text and the footnotes, where you're kind of going back and forth, and things do form a sort of infinite loop. But if you just let it, if you just go with it, like, there's something to be found on every one of those sections. And to try, like, a friend, Brian Wood, who's a writer for Post Magazine and a great short story writer, mentioned that when he was reading Infinite Jest and studied it, they talked about how it has a rhizomatic structure, like a Deleuzian sort of structure, and that people nowadays like arbors, like Jonathan Franzen, who I'm glad that we're talking about David Foster Wallace and not Jonathan Franzen this week, and that people like that simplicity and that, like, fully round, I can understand this, all the pieces go together, that's great. Whereas this is more lifelike in the sense that there are fragments and there are pieces and they hook up, but they don't have to hook up into one big thing. Just let the book take you.
Right. I think that's a great comment. And as someone who teaches, this is the type of conversation I have a lot with students who often want to solve the novel, or they're looking for the answer to the novel. And novels generally don't have answers, right? And that the notion of immersive is very powerful. So really when we're reading, what the writer's asking us is to follow his or her imagination and where it takes him or her. And we're really engaged in a consciousness that is trying to do things with language. And that's what he did really well. So the notion of immersion is really powerful. You know, I have this story I tell about teaching detective fiction. And my students sometimes, when there are too many characters, like a big book like this, they get mad because they'll say, "I can't figure out who the killer is." And I'm always saying, you know, by the end of the novel, the detective will tell you. You just have to keep reading.
Ricky, I want to ask Ricky quickly, because we got to get to a break here that we're a little bit late for. Have you found rewards in reading it? Has it been anything other than a slog?
Oh, it's very rewarding. You know, I like all the advertisements in it, but I mean, I'm on page like 490, so I don't know if I'm going to stop. And
good for you.
You're doing well.
I'm
on 345 right now, so
you're good.
Music on and keep listening, and boom, hit it. But I'm just wondering, was David Foster Wallace on something when he wrote this?
No.
I want to get to that. That's a great point. That's a great point. I want to hit that. We do have to take a quick break. We are talking about David Foster Wallace with Chad Post, Steve Brower, Sarah Freely, and Christopher Duva. Am I pronouncing that right, Chris?
Yes.
Duva, thank you, is on the phone with us from New York City, where we want to talk to him more about a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again, the one-man play. And we will continue right after this here on Member Supported Public Radio. In our next hour on Connections Innovation Friday, how easy is it to cast a ballot if disabilities keep you from using a standard voting machine? The Center for Disability Rights is trying to make some changes to improve dismal voting numbers. We'll talk with two of the people behind its new initiative, and then we'll hear from the CEO of the company that plans to grow medical marijuana at Rochester's Eastman Business Park. Stay with us.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Corning Museum of Glass, presenting its contemporary art and design wing. The new space features 120 contemporary works in glass and a 500-seat hot glass demonstration space. CMOG.org. And Gardner Plus Architects, providing planning, architectural, and consulting services to the healthcare sector and other industries for more than two decades. Designing environments for the future, GardnerPlus.com.
And welcome back to Connections Arts Friday. Evan Dawson has the day off. I'm Scott Feibusch, and before Evan took the day off, he said, "Hey, you want to do a David Foster Wallace show?" And I said, "You know, I got to actually read the books if we're going to do that." So we are talking about David Foster Wallace. And about his books, some of which are rather massive, like Infinite Jest, which we were talking about right before the break. In studio with us, Chad Post is the publisher of Open Letter Books at the University of Rochester. Steve Brower is an associate professor of English at St. John Fisher. Sarah Freely is an associate professor of creative writing at Fisher and a poet and a writer of fiction. And you're not a Fisher now, or you
not,
are?
Nope, just left.
Oh, you just left.
Just finished.
A former
I'm
associate.
On the Infinite Summer.
There we go. Okay. And on the phone with us, Christopher Duva is in New York City, and he is an actor and writer and the star of a new one-man play called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, based on a wonderful David Foster Wallace essay. And we want you to join us, too, if you have thought about reading Foster Wallace, if you have been sucked into it, if you have tried it and said it's not for me, give us a call now. Let us know what you think. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. On Twitter, I am at Scott Feibusch. And we continue with the conversation. And Chad, I want to kick off with you here because there's a story that you want to tell about the first page of Infinite Jest and
yes.
Yahoo Answers.
A few years ago, I found this thing. It floated around the internet a little bit, but someone had taken the first page of Infinite Jest and put it on to like Yahoo's forum, Yahoo Answers thing, saying, "This is the first page of this book that I'm writing, and I just want to know what people think of it, and you know what I should do, so on and so forth." Then every comment was like, "This is horrible! Like, how this is the worst writing. Put it in a drawer, lose it, burn it. You're clearly not a writer." And it was so funny to see that, like, the vast majority of people didn't recognize
well,
where
this
is from.
Well, that's kind of like when they put Yasha Heifetz in the subway and have...
yeah, exactly. What, yeah. And then I thought it would be great to put, like, Stephanie Meyer's Twilight page one on there, but then everyone would just be like, "Oh, it's Twilight." Like,
right.
Whatever. Like,
that was basically Harold Bloom's reaction to Infinite Jest. He hated it. I think he called it a mess. But Harold Bloom doesn't like anything.
I was going to say, there were some vicious reviews of it at the time.
Oh.
I was a little bit surprised myself when I started reading. I was expecting it to be a more difficult read than it turned out to be.
Right.
You know, and his writing, even when he's into something that is so complicated and so deeply within his own mind, as Infinite Jest is, it's still you can follow the writing. He's not, you know, I didn't have to go to the dictionary every 2 seconds to figure out, okay, what word is he using to try to throw me here. You can follow it, which is not true of some of these other post modernist writers.
Well, those 60s writers that we were talking about before, Gaddis, they will be challenging in a different way. But I think he believed in story. I think, he, you know, there is a story here. And as you were talking, Chad, I mean, the challenge is part of it, as Scott, as you're implying, is the weight of it, the heavy. This is a big book, and it takes a long time, as Ricky was saying. I'm 490 pages in, and oh my God, I'm not even halfway. But there are real pleasures, and I talk about this a lot with students. Like, what are our reading practices? What do we read for? Some of us read for story. We want narrative. Some of us read for language, right? We want to have the joy of the language, and others read for other reasons, just for basic pleasure, for whatever reason that might be.
There was a class that he taught at Illinois State that was on that included only books that he hadn't finished, which started with Gass's Omensetter's Luck, and like I forget what the other ones were, but I wasn't in the class, but someone told me about it. But it was based around books that he hadn't finished that he wanted to include
and
in the
I
class
know,
to see why.
Yeah, and I know in some of the classes he taught, because his syllabi are always sort of floating around the web, right?
They are.
He often taught commercial fiction to see with his students what's going on in this that we can learn from, that we can engage with. There's a reason readers are reading Twilight, for instance, that rather than just dismiss it, what would happen if we actually engage it on its own terms?
I would love to have seen you mentioned Franzen before, Chad. I would love to have seen if this had been chosen for Oprah's book club.
Oh my,
that would have
Been a really different scenario.
They were great friends. They were great friends.
Yes.
They were.
But I can, he would have had a different response to the book club, I think. Because he was a very private person from everything. I did not know him, but I know people who did, who talked to him, as a very private person. But he also seemed to love people. Mm-hmm. And he loved engaging with who was in front of him. That seemed actually really important to him.
Yeah.
Sir?
I was going to, going back to what you were saying about the, that he loved story. More than anyone, he brought so much into the story beyond just chronology and linearity of telling the story, is that I think his talent was really for synthesizing so many things. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this book you have media theory, you have sports, you have addiction, you have, like film studies, and yet he throws all this in and it becomes, rather than being a polemic, it becomes part of the narrative. Narrative per se, because he really did want to disrupt. He said he wanted to disrupt the linearity and threw in the footnotes.
I want to get back to a point that came up just before the break about addiction. And I mean, there is no way that portions of this book dealing with rehab and dealing with drug use could have been written by anybody who wasn't intimately familiar with the effects that these drugs have, with the process of taking drugs, with the process of rehab. Talk to me a little bit, Sarah. You'd mentioned that when he wrote this, he was not on anything, but he was on the experience of having come out of rehab. Situate the book within his personal life.
Well, going back to what we were talking about, he started in 86, and I believe, that was before he talks in the movie addresses the stint he did it at McLean, and the David Lipsky character, there's been rumors you use heroin. I never use heroin. So that if we understand that the bulk of the writing of this book was probably done post-1990, it was just his influence probably more than drugs was television. Go ahead.
Sorry, just to add to that, there is a really great biography. Every love story is a ghost story by B.T. Mack that talks about it. And as Sarah said, the writing was split over many years and actually changed direction. And during that time, I think a lot under the influence of Mary Carr, the writer Mary Carr, whom he was involved with at the time in Syracuse, New York, after he moved there, after he did his stint at McLean in rehab. And he was coy about it in the sort of, I guess coy is the wrong word. He was he protected his private life and also what he felt was the pledge of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is that it is anonymous and the people who are not in the program do not talk about the program. The people in the program do not talk about the program. So he had something to protect, but also took those experiences. And many of the people who have been who were portrayed in the book are directly from his experience in rehab at McLean. And while he was, after he had withdrawn from the graduate philosophy department at Harvard.
He and Mary Carr initially met in Boston. She details that pretty extensively in Lit. her last memoir.
I'm sympathetic to people wanting to make connections between writers' lives and what they write, because I think that's a very sort of human response. Like, how do I put this? How do these equal equations? But at the same time, you know, as a literary critic, my main feeling is thanks. My main response to that is that act of doing that takes away our interest in our engagement with the writer's imagination, which is really what a creative work is. It's and the creative nonfiction just as well. Like, there is something that the pleasure for me of reading a Wallace is my ability to follow along his mind at work. And it's an amazing mind. Well, it's really his essay on the dictionary, on usage. I remember reading that going, this is awesome. Like, how is he doing this with all these balls in the air?
Steve is coming out. He's declaring himself not to be a theorist and is declaring himself to be a new critic.
And something of a geek, clearly, because I like the usage essay.
Well, I do.
But I'll say as a reader that one of the things that sucked me in very quickly into Infinite Jest in particular, having lived in Boston, having worked in the Alston-Brighton area, and driven through Watertown every day going home, there is no way that you can write with that level of detail and without having personally observed it.
Lived experience
it. It was
important.
Phenomenal. I mean, just the level of observation about that area.
Absolutely. No, I think that's true. And but what most excites me is then what do you do with that? Because we've all had different experiences, and we see them sometimes reflected in film and in novels, poetry. But what's exciting, what makes it art, is what that individual does with that that goes beyond the individual. So absolutely, close observation. And, go ahead, Chris.
Sorry, just to add to that, exactly, and more to the point, I mean, I know we get stuck on Infinite Jest because it's sort of his, you know, Ulysses.
Yeah.
But, for example, the last piece he was working on was The Pale King, which is such wonderful pieces of writing, and regardless of, I mean, the writing in itself stands alone, but then, I mean, he was such an omnivore and so attuned to detail. I mean, he basically went through the entire academic training to become a certified CPA so he could write with a level of detail about accountancy that he felt comfortable with. He was trying to figure out a way to write a novel about boredom without being boring.
Boring.
I mean, so the amount of things, levels of challenges that he took on as an artist were just sort of incredible. And I mean, the more you know about his life, the more incredible they seem, with both the hurdles he overcame and also the amount of research and learning and education that he did to accomplish it.
Indeed. We are talking about David Foster Wallace. This is Connections Arts Friday. I'm Scott Feibusch. In for Evan Dawson, we have Sarah Freely here. We have Steve Brower from St. John Fisher. We have Chad Post from Open Letter Books on the phone with us. Christopher Duva from New York. And you can join us, too, at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. If you want to get into the conversation, we only have a few minutes left in this hour. Chris, I want to ask you, as an actor creating a one-man play, you don't have the luxury of being able to step aside and say, I don't want to think about the author in connection with what he's written, because you're going out there and doing a one-man play about it. Talk to me about that experience and what that's been like for you.
It's been fantastic. I mean, I've always felt since the moment, I mean, one of the things that I think has sort of become a cliche, but is very true about Wallace's writing is that people say that what he really captured was the brain voice. And to me, that same voice, to, you know, echo back to how all of this stuff has been before and will be again, you know, to me as an actor, that brain voice is the same thing that Shakespeare and Shaw sort of got in their monologues, which was like deliriously entertaining ways to convey complex emotional and intellectual ideas. And David's writing was always that for me, and that's one of the things I corresponded with him about that I felt would work so well for the stage. And the delight about this production and the reviews we received, and you know, we sold out our Fringe run and now we're coming back for the Fringe Encore series, is that it's sort of been proven right that it is. It's a 80-minute monologue that takes you through this man's inner experience of going on a cruise ship and all of his delightful observations on it, and that it works really well on the stage because he's such a phenomenal writer.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. Sarah and I think we're both wanting the same thing at the same time. Do you wear the bandana on stage and the glasses?
The bandana is worn, yes. although technically he talks about, and it's excised from the show. Well, I mean, the show, if you read it out loud, the actual essay, if you read it out loud, is 10.5 hours long.
Yeah.
So the show is a very, very condensed version. But on the ship, he actually mostly wore a Spider-Man cap that he never revealed the backstory of. And not sure why he was wearing a Spider-Man
and the tuxedo T-shirt.
The tuxedo T-shirt was the same thing I was thinking of.
Well, and so the show, I want to make sure that we get it. It's going to be appearing in just a couple of weeks, if I'm correct, at the Fringe Encore?
Yeah, the Fringe Encore series in New York City, and it'll be running from September 13th to the 22nd.
Excellent.
At the Soho Playhouse in Manhattan.
Any plans to take it on the road? Will we see it up here at some point?
That's sort of what the Fringe Encore series is, sort of a lab to try and get interest in more productions. Hopefully, a run in New York and elsewhere.
Well, next hour we have the folks from Jiva Theater coming in. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, great!
I'm gonna make sure to get a plug in for that. I want to see
them
this. Yeah, absolutely. We'll come back and do another Wallace panel when we do this. I want to get this in before the end of the hour, so we don't completely end on a dark note. But obviously, you can't talk about Wallace without talking about what he did to himself. Sarah reminded us we're coming up on the anniversary in just a week or so.
September 12th.
So it's exactly a week from now. How, if at all, should Wallace's suicide affect our reading of him now?
Oh, man.
Is that, I didn't want to end the hour with this.
Yeah, that's a dark question. You're right. I mean, I don't know about how to get to that point, but to start, he did. I mean, he was depressed and had depression problems. He talked a lot to people that were friends of his about his antidepressant medications. We all know the history of the electroshock, all that kind of stuff. And I think that the thing that maybe stands out to me, I mean, that was a tragedy. I remember getting the text messages the night that he died from people saying, you know, I've just heard this, it's a rumor, but it seems to be very true. And it was very profoundly shaking to a lot of people. I guess, like, the thing is that he couldn't get out of his head, and he couldn't not be aware of all the failings of being human and all the difficulties of living your life. And I think that that's part of what resonates through all of these books and all
Absolutely.
The different sections. It's that. And the fact that he ended before he could have done more things is very sad. But I can also see that, like, he was struggling, I think, with trying to figure out what was next. I know after he wrote Infinite Jest was a huge deal, when he was working on Oblivion, the short stories, he had told a friend of mine that he was trying to figure out how to write again.
Sure.
He didn't know how to write the next thing. What do you do now? And I think that that's something that he kept running up against and trying to keep it very human. And I think that maybe that's the only way that I can go back and read him is through that lens.
Yeah, that's in my thinking about him, reading his fiction, it's very much about this notion of trying to engage, right? Trying to be engaged and be in it. And of course, that's similar to the reading experience. It's hard not to think always about his commencement speech at Kenyon that became This Is Water, where he talks explicitly about the need for individuals to try to get out of their head, try to get out of their, what do you call it, the default setting, and be connected to those around us. Have that act of imagination, of empathy, that takes us into another soul, another consciousness, and understand that what's going on for us isn't the only defining moment here. But that was, you know, and he talks about suicide in that piece, and it's kind of devastating to read that after the fact. And
And in Infinite Jest too. I mean, that's
running. But this is, I do. I think Chad nailed it with getting, like, it enables us to see what's going on in the fiction, both for his characters and for the writer himself.
I downloaded some quotes from the commencement speech he gave at Kenyon, because we were talking early on about how will we remember him? What is his legacy? And I think a lot of people now don't read, they might not read his work, either as creative nonfiction or his fiction, but they're familiar with that from the YouTube going around. It goes around every during the valedictory season. And reading it again and listening to it again, where he says the really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty, little, unsexy ways every day. And to read that in light of his death, it seems like he was not just speaking to them, but he was trying to remind himself that this is what you have to do, is that you can't, you know, being a veteran of the, he was a veteran of the rooms, and that's, you know, like one day at a time, you build a wall up around the day, and you live just for that day. And for some reason, you know, the depression, he was just falling and couldn't grab onto anything. So he, to hear that is heartbreaking.
Chris, does it play into when you're on the stage portraying him?
Well, it becomes he wrote about it in a supposedly fun thing. It as it permeates throughout all his writing, a tremendous amount of despair. And while it's an extremely funny piece, there are moments, I don't want to give away anything, any endings for people who might see it, but it does turn serious. And he talks about how despair is, he says it's a word that's been overused and banalified, but it's a serious word and he uses it seriously. And how tied into that, great, I mean, I don't know. I kind of feel it might be a cliche, but having such a finely tuned antenna is both going to open you up to the comedy and the wonders of the world, but also the tremendous amount of pain. And unfortunately, he succumbed. I just feel like the world is such a better place for him having been in it. It's great that the conversation about him continues.
Well, that's the conundrum of the writer, I think, that you just hit on really beautifully, and that's that you have to be tough enough to withstand rejection and people ignoring you, or on the other hand, people paying too much attention to you, but you have to remain vulnerable enough to produce, to write, to communicate on that level, and it's tough. Particularly for someone who suffered from problems with mental illness the way he did. I can't imagine it.
Yeah. Let's try to take this to a little bit.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Scott.
Brighter moment as we that's why I did this when we still had a few minutes left in the show. So Sarah, you made the case earlier that if somebody comes to you and says, okay, I'm interested in this, I've spent an hour listening to this radio show about this guy that I've never read before, you would start them off with one of his collections of essays?
I would. And I'd point them to YouTube and say, here he is speaking. It's a wonderful commencement address. And you get to see him.
And there's a playfulness in that, right,
with
the opening anecdote that gets back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier. Like his earlier work is challenging, right? It's sort of that postmodern feel where you see this young writer showing off a little bit. Look what I can do, and I'm a little better than other people.
A little bit?
Yeah, yeah. But then as he matured, as we talked about, there's something deeper that goes on. It's not hard to imagine why there's a distance between with what became Pale King, because this notion, Chad, you're saying of, like, I have to relearn how to write. He gave everything he had.
Yeah.
You know, it's really quite astounding.
It's hard not to feel, for me, as I'm going through Infinite Jest, you know, against the backdrop of knowing what happened to him, it's like, wow, he's downloading his entire brain here.
Right.
I'm just swimming around in his brain. What is left when he gets done with this?
Right. Yeah, that's an impressive thing. There's not a lot of authors that do that and that do it at this level. There's virtually none, but like not a lot of people that go all in and give you everything they can with such care and precision.
I don't think there's a lot of male authors that do. I think there's plenty of women that do, but not a lot of male authors that do to open up like that.
To open up. Yeah, yeah, okay. Fair enough. I mean, as a writer's craft, just giving all that you can as a writer, all of your abilities, all of your things. I think that there's a lot of contemporary writers that are shortcutting and doing things that are more self-involved than David did.
And also, just for that introduction for David's writing, I mean, it's sort of, in the terms of him being an omnivore, like, if you are a fan of movies, then his essays on David Lynch,
yes.
for Premiere Magazine, where I believe the first line is, "The first time I see David Lynch, he is peeing against a tree." I mean, you know, he wrote a huge piece about the Adult Video News Awards for, yes, Premiere Magazine.
Oh, I remember that one, right? Yes.
The Krushka piece. There's Consider the Lobster. If you're a sports fan, there's the piece on Roger Federer. Yeah,
yeah. I'm gonna, as a radio talk show host, I'm gonna put the plug in for the piece he did for Harper's about John Ziegler in Los Angeles. Yes. Right.
Yeah, the host. Yeah, I mean, he just covered everything in our culture, McCain,
yep,
et cetera.
Absolutely. What would you want him, if you could be the Harper's editor right now? We're down to our final seconds. Real quick, what would you send him out to cover right now?
Trump.
Yeah, Trump isn't going to be my answer, yeah, too. But
absolutely. We have been talking about David Foster Wallace with Chad Post from Open Letter Books at the University of Rochester, Steve Brower at St. John Fisher, poet, writer Sarah Freely, and joining us on the phone, Christopher Duva in New York City. If you get a chance, go down and see A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, and hopefully it'll come here too. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll be talking about Jiva next hour. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, right here on member-supported Public Radio.